about the same time, pogroms across Europe, these organized massacres of Jews were taking place in Russia and Poland and places. And ultimately then the Holocaust and the pogroms and Zionist movement and the Holocaust all kind of served to bring the Jews to the land of Palestine in the late 1800s to the mid 1900s, getting into the 1940s. At the end of World War I, you might recall that the British had been given a mandate. They'd been given mandatory powers to oversee, to keep the peace, to govern this land of Palestine with this mixture of people, these Jews and Arabs, those of the Muslim religion. Except putting Jews and Arabs together is kind of like, have you ever had one of those fish called a betta, and you made the mistake of putting another one in there too? If you can imagine being the policeman for two bettas in the fish tank, you know, you can kind of imagine the situation that Britain was in. Britain sure didn't do everything right. They didn't do a lot of things well in that era at that with that assignment, but it really was a futile thing. I mean, it's kind of like us thinking that we can keep psycho Muslim people from blowing themselves up in Iraq. You know, it's just, how many troops are you going to put in there before you? I mean, we could send one troop for every citizen of Iraq, and maybe then we could follow them around. But it's not really a realistic thing. And for Britain then to try and keep the peace between the Jews and the Muslims, boy, that was tough. And so with the conflicts and the violence, and there was a lot of violence, not only Arabs against Jews, but Jews were retaliating. And also, nobody liked Britain being there. And so Britain was getting attacked. And it was just the conflicts and the violence made them say, you know what? We want out of here, okay? They went to the UN and said, you know, now it was the UN. They had been assigned the mandatory powers by the League of Nations, but now the League of Nations, what's the opposite of predecessor? Postdecessor? Anyway, the United Nations kind of got this dumped in their lap, and Britain said, we're not going to be here very much longer, so you need to work this out. And so the United Nations in 1947 proposed a partition plan where they took the land of Israel and said, okay, we're going to divide this up. And it seemed to have, if you look at the map, it seemed to have no rhyme or reason. They were basing it on population, where they said, look, you know, half of the Arabs are here, plus about 10,000 Jews, so we'll give them that. And then the rest of it is about, oh, maybe 60% Jewish, 40% Arab, so we'll give the Jews that. Now, again, I don't know how that was supposed to solve anything, but that was their plan. And so they proposed this partition plan. It would establish two separate states. You know, we think of, you know, countries kind of thing. There'd be the Palestinian state, there'd be a Jewish state. And this plan was supposed to go into effect on the date of Britain's withdrawal from Palestine. So the day they left, this would go into place. The majority of the Jews actually supported the plan because they looked at it and said, hey, the UN is about to recognize us as a country, as a sovereign state. You know, finally the dream that we've had for so long, really for 2,000 years, but specifically for the last 50 or 60 years of we could have our own nation again, that was going to happen. The Arabs, not so much. The Arabs, the only way to describe it is the Arabs went on a rampage. And I don't just mean the Arabs of Palestine. I'm talking about the Arabs of the world. The Arab delegations in the UN stormed out when this was proposed the Jews were happy about it. Well, the UN delegates to the Arab nations got up and stormed out and caused a scene. Many of the Muslim nations not only rejected the plan, as you might expect, but then they threatened the destruction of the Jews in Palestine. Remember, the majority of these people are civilians. They've just escaped the Holocaust. And here are the Arabs saying, we're going to finish off the genocide. We're going to wipe you out. Members of the Arab Liberation Army infiltrated into Palestine from Syria and Jordan and Amman. But none of this stuff was going to keep the British from leaving. You know, the British were more than happy to leave. So May 14th, 1948, They pulled down the Union Jack, you know, the British flag. They pulled it down, and the flag of Israel flew over it. See, all the Arab nations had rejected the partition plan, and the Jews are like, well, it's neither here nor there. We accept it. So, you know, we'll take our state, you know, thank you very much kind of thing. They were legally recognized by the United Nations, by the members of the United Nations, including the United States and the USSR, the Soviet Union, legally recognized as, okay, we acknowledge you as a country now. Well, there was going to be no honeymoon. You know, it'd be nice, you know, hey, we just got our country. Let's spruce the place up, put up some curtains, you know, maybe talk about how we're going to do this whole president thing. Maybe we might need an army, you know, these kind of things. Can you imagine being given the job of starting a new country? It's hard enough to move into a new house, you know, but a whole country with a whole system of government and government and taxes and military service and just what would you do? Well, they didn't have any time to figure that stuff out. It was the day after May 14th, 1948, they were, you know, recognized as a state. May 15th, Egyptian planes bombed Tel Aviv. And the Arab nations, five Arab nations, ultimately would be six, five Arab nations, the armies invaded from all sides. Literally, if you look at a map of Israel, to the west, they have a bunch of water. But from the north and the northeast and the east and the southeast and the south, invasion. Arab armies invading from five and ultimately six nations invading this, you know, we're a one-day-old country. What would you do? I mean, I can't imagine what you would do. The leader of the Arab League declared, this will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades. So he quoted two times in history when many, many, many Jews were killed and in that area, and says, this will be a war of extermination, a momentous massacre. Well, all Israel had for an army at this point was the Haganah, now, which is a great kind of ice cream, I guess. But the Haganah, Britain had been falling short terribly. They were not great policemen. They were not great governors, you know. And so when the Arabs would commit acts of terrorism against Jews, and the Jews are sitting here looking at the British going, aren't you in charge here? Are you going to do anything about this? They realized, hey, if our citizens are going to be protected, then we need to protect ourselves. So they formed this, the only way to describe it is an underground militia. And at this point, 1948, they had about 10,000 across of the 640,000 people that were in Israel. There was 10,000 of these underground militia that would protect Israeli citizens from attack as well as they could. They also had a hand in when the British said during World War II, you know, you can't, you know, issued the white paper. We talked about the white paper of, no, all these Jews that are trying to escape the Holocaust, they can't come here, because that would upset the Arabs. So the Haganah also had a big, big part in basically illegally bringing Jewish refugees into the land of Palestine. So here's the Haganah. We've got 10,000, you know, ground troops, infantrymen here. And okay, you guys are the army. You know, the officially, the government essentially 12 days after the Arab-Israeli war began. And that's what this was the Arab-Israeli war. 12 days after this began, the new Israeli government said, okay, you know, you guys are the army. Can you imagine? We were just like cops. We were like the neighborhood watch, you know. But in fact, they were pretty adept at weaponry and strategy. And, you know, they took all that great Jewish mind that seems to be so prominent in this people and applied it to strategy. And so here, now today we call them the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF. And just about everybody in Israel, when we think of it, when they're out of high school, they go and serve for about 3 years. So you can imagine how unifying that is to the Israeli public today. Back then, they didn't have much of an army. Transjordan, this was the nation across the Jordan, hence the name, had taken most of the center territory, which was allotted for the Palestinian Arabs. So it was kind of interesting. They're like, we're going to attack Israel. And they looked at the UN partition plan and said, let's invade where the Arabs live. Okay. Today, if you know your map today, it's called the West Bank. Okay. It's this big chunk of the middle of Israel there, next to the West Bank of the Jordan River. And so they took over that. They also took East Jerusalem. They killed many and forced out the rest of the Jews that were living in Jerusalem. The war lasted a year. And, you know, Israel was certainly able to get their act together during that year. Actually won. I mean, won. And if you think about this, we just started the country yesterday. And we won a war against six nations that have been around for a long time, that have established armies and equipment and everything else. 1% of the Jewish population died. That's, you know, that might not seem like a lot for a nation of 640,000 people, but it's still, I mean, it's almost 7,000 people. But if 1% of the United States population died in a war, that's pretty major. So to them, it was the same thing. One out of every 100 people we knew, you know, died. What was interesting was they won. 640,000 people in Israel, Jews. They fought six countries whose citizenry totaled 30 million people. So you've got about 500,000 versus 30 million. Now, obviously, not everybody's fighting, but essentially, you've got one brand new country against six countries with real armies. You've got about 500,000 people in your country versus 30 million people, and they had actually won. Miraculously is the only way I can describe it. And because we're focusing mostly on history, I won't give you a lot of the kind of supernatural accounts that many of the soldiers gave during this time. But it was beyond a miracle. It was a miracle of biblical proportions, if you look at it this way. It was the real David and Goliath kind of thing. Plus, remember that Transjordan had you know, invaded and taken over territories. Well, okay, now we're in a war. We were happy with our portion that the UN gave us. Well, now we're in a war fighting for our lives. And as they're fighting, they're occupying territory. It's, hey, all's fair in love and war, right? Isn't that what they say? Well, it's not like there's rules. Hey, you crossed our line. You're not allowed to cross our line. It's war, dummy. So, not you, dummy, the one who would, you know. So not only had they occupied all of the land that the UN had granted to them, all of it, like they didn't lose any of it with all these Muslims invading, but also they got the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which had not originally been in the plan, but they, you know, they won it fair and square. There was an Israeli-Egypt armistice signed in February 1949 where those boundaries were agreed upon. Egypt did agree to those boundaries. It's like, hey, okay, we'll stop this fighting. They were losing so bad. You know, they said, okay, time out. Let's have peace, you know. Okay, this is what we've occupied. Do you agree to that? Yes, let's sign it. So, in addition, during that year, 600,000 Palestinian Arabs left. Some of them were expelled. The majority of them fled. You know, it's like, you know, we didn't really pick this fight because, you know, we're just kind of here. Not really. They didn't really not pick the fight. They had been fighting all along, but now we're talking about tanks and stuff, so we're out of here. So they left. 600,000 Arabs left. They went to Syria. They went to Lebanon. They went to Egypt. They went to Jordan. And what's interesting about this, and this never gets talked about, because we only talk about the poor Palestinians that are so oppressed in Israel, right? You hear about this all the time. Well, guess what? Those poor Palestinians that left and went to Egypt and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, they're still there. You know, a few generations past now, they're still living in miserable conditions in refugee camps, not accepted as citizens of these, you know, Egypt and Syria and these countries cry out and say, oh, our Muslim brothers are suffering under the brutal hand of the Jews. Well, what about the Palestinian Muslims that are in your own country that you're making live like in third world nation poverty. Why are they doing that? Well, imagine why they're doing that. They refuse to assimilate them into their populations because it makes perfect propaganda and it breeds hatred of the Jews. Because they can point and say, oh, look at these poor people and the people there. Why are we here? Well, the Jews drove us out. So it creates a lot of suicide bombers and hyper, you know, psycho Muslim fundamentalist kind of people. So it's a real log in your own eye kind of mentality there. For the next 7 years after that, so the war is over. For the next 7 years, Israel's population of Jews continued to grow because of immigration from all over the world. Jews were coming. They were coming from America, and they're coming from Russia, and they're coming from all over the place. While the hatred of the Arab nations for Israel festered. I mean, it was really, you know, now they had a reason because they're licking their wounds because they just got messed up bad. I mean, it's kind of like the bully picked a fight with the little nerd guy at school and the nerd guy beat him to a pulp. You know, that's sort of the way to think of this. And so, you know, the bully is now pretty angry. Egypt's president at the time, I'm going to mess up the pronunciation of his name, but he's dead, so it doesn't matter. Gamal Abdel Nasser, if that's close enough. He was Egypt's president at the time. He had actually overthrown Egypt's last king, and so he's now the president. He says this. He says, the present situation requires the mobilization of all Arab strength to liquidate the state that has arisen in our region. What is he saying? It's every Muslim's obligation, every Muslim nation's obligation to come in and wipe Israel out, to liquidate it, to flatten it, to kill every Jew there. And so along the Gaza Strip, which Egypt had control over here, along the Gaza Strip, Egypt sends and allows, it's politically correct to say allows instead of sends, allowed guerrilla terrorists to come in and launch terror attacks and killed hundreds of Jewish citizens there launching from the Gaza Strip. And then Nasser picks a fight. If you're familiar with the way that water flows in that part, you've got the Gulf of Aqaba, and that's how you get into all the waterways going north up towards Israel and the rest of it. So he blockaded that. It was kind of like, you know, he built ships and built a blockade that prevented any trade from coming in to this important port in Israel, and then he annexed the Suez Canal, which made France mad, made England mad, and certainly Israel sitting here going, is anybody going to do anything about this? So France and England and Israel together formulated a plan. France and England, knowing that the Muslim nations hated Israel, and so they had to control their part and say, look, you guys are only allowed to do this. You know, just invade this area and don't go any further. We'll take care of this. It was very, you know, they were very aware that if all the Muslim nations declared war against France and Britain, you know, they were going to be in trouble. So you would think we'd understand that in our nation as well, but we'll just keep hitting one after the other until they all decide they're going to blow us up. So they are, this is in 1956, they are victorious, but the United States and the USSR get in the middle of this and force the withdrawal and say, look, this is not allowed. You know, this is the modern age, and in spite of what Egypt has done, we need to play nice. So we'll send in a UN peacekeeping force to keep the waterways open, but you need to leave, okay? And you need to give back this territory that you took. So that was in 1956, and it was a military victory, but it was a political defeat for Israel, because they were told, you know, bad Israel, no biscuit kind of thing. You know, you have to give all this back and like pull out. Then 1967. So we're talking 11 years later. Nasser is still president of Egypt, and he drove out. He expelled the UN peacekeepers and blockaded everything again. Before the end of that month, May of 1967, he had done what he said he was going to do, allying Arab nations together. Again, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, these nations, and had gotten commitments. Okay, very soon here, we're going to launch an attack against Israel, and together we will all just massacre them. The attack was coming within days. Israeli intelligence found this out and preemptively struck. You know, it said, we're not waiting for y'all to try and invade us at once. We're going to deal with this. So they sent their Air Force. Now, isn't this awesome? It's 1967. It's, 19 years now? And they've got a full-on Air Force and crack paratrooper divisions and all these things. They made a country. These people moved to the desert and made a country. I could never imagine doing that. And I think we need to always keep that in mind. And they're constantly fighting for their lives because they're surrounded by people that hate them. Well, they flew and struck 11 Egyptian Air Force bases. See, before Egypt's planes got off the ground to just destroy the Jews said, well, we'll just destroy the planes. They hit 11 Egyptian Air Force bases, and that day destroyed 90% of Egypt's Air Force because they were all on the ground. They were all on the ground. They were parked, you know. It's like, hey, look at that. This is great, you know. So then it became a ground war, and of course it was a war. 1967, it's called the Six-Day War. Can you guess why? Interesting. Israel's army pushes into strategic territory. If you know the lay of the land in Israel, there are places, there are high places that it's very easy to launch missiles and things and attacks and mortars from these high cliff areas. And unfortunately, those were all in Syrian territory, Lebanon's territory. So you're just a sitting duck. You're sitting here, you know, looking up at this mountain going, hey, look at all those bad guys up there setting up mortars, you know. So they pushed into these territories, strategically taking them so they couldn't be attacked from there. That's when they took the Golan Heights from Syria. And maybe these things sound familiar to you if you watch the news. We've talked about the Gaza Strip and the West Bank and the Golan Heights. These are all still key disputed areas. They took the Golan Heights from Syria. They took the West Bank, the whole West Bank from Jordan. The Gaza Strip they took from Egypt. They also captured Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. You know, the Sinai down there that they had taken during this whole French-English-Israeli, battle that they'd had against Egypt. They'd taken the whole Sinai Peninsula, and the U.S. and the USSR said, you have to give that back. Well, they took it again. You know, it's like, hey, this is a real war, and we took this. So in the second time in 11 years, they took the Sinai Peninsula. But probably in this, the most important acquisition was that of Jerusalem. They had never got the eastern part of Jerusalem, and certainly not the Old City. And by the Old City, we're talking about original City of David, biblical Jerusalem, you know, back when they first moved into Jerusalem, as the Old City. So they took this. They finally, in June of 1967, they had possession of biblical Jerusalem, and they had taken the land of Canaan. So it was very spiritual. It wasn't just a military kind of thing. If you read the books about this, you'll see that this was very much on the hearts of a lot of people, you know, and they blew the shofar. The rabbi came in and blew the shofar, and it was just a real kind of very spiritual thing for them. What's interesting, though, is the Israeli government, not as spiritual for them, they came out and said, look, to the nations that were planning to attack them and the nations that they had taken territory from, you know, Egypt and Syria and Jordan, they contacted them diplomatically and said, here's the deal. We will give back everything we took in this war if you swear peace with us. You know, if you'll sign a peace treaty, if there can be peace between your country and our country, a permanent, lasting peace, then we'll give all this stuff back to you. Now, to me, that's amazing. Why in the world you would give back Jerusalem when you finally got it after 2,000 years? But, you know, in the interest of peace, we don't want to live under the threat of attack. And let's face it, we just creamed you guys bad again. But no answer. No answer. They were so humiliated that Egypt didn't respond. Jordan didn't respond. Syria didn't respond. And so Israel, after a couple months, took the offer off the table. Said, okay, this isn't disputed anymore. We have this. Interesting, today they call it the disputed territories. And yet, even in 1967, they offered, they said, you know what? You can have this back if you promise peace. Interesting. So, after the Six-Day War, the PLO had formed, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Yasser Arafat took leadership of this in 1969. And in the years to follow, if you're familiar with the PLO, you know that they bombed school buses full of Israeli children. It's just beyond words to talk about the terrorism that the Palestine Liberation Organization under Yasser Arafat did. Plane hijackings, school bus bombings. If you were around in 1972, you probably remember very clearly the masked gunman in the Olympic Village who took hostage and then murdered 11 of the Olympic athletes from Israel. It was in the Summer Olympics of 1972 in Munich, Germany. That was a group, what was it, Black September, I think. I forget the name of the group now, something September, but run by the PLO. So murder of Olympic athletes, bombing school children in their buses. This is not a military thing. This was just out-and-out terrorism. And really, a lot of historians mark the Munich massacre at the Olympics as the beginning of modern terrorism, of big time, you know, we don't care who we're attacking if we get the biggest response kind of terrorism that we see all over the world today. You know, in spite of the terrorism, the Israeli citizens had a feeling of, okay, we're dealing with terrorists, you know, individually, but as far as countries go, man, we've just beat the pulp out of all our surrounding Muslim neighbors twice, and Egypt three times. We're fine. We are safe. And so, you know, they moved on with their lives. At the point where it had been 6 years since they'd had a war, they got real comfortable. Before Iraq, I remember us talking. How long have we been in Iraq? 2 years now, something. I remember, you know, somewhat recently, last couple of years, talking about how long it had been since we'd been in a war. We've got a whole generation that's grown up without being in a war, and we had forgotten about it. Well, it only took Israel 6 years to kind of get to the place of fat, dumb, and happy. You know, we'd rather hang out at the coffee shop and be intellectual and you know, go to the theater than really worry about, I mean, you know, come on, we can beat any of these people. Well, 1973 came. It was the day of Yom Kippur. And if you're familiar with Yom Kippur, you know it's the holiday. It's the Jewish holiday where the Jews humble themselves before God. They afflict their souls. It's, you know, they're not out at the movies. They're not even driving cars. You know, the streets are totally deserted. The only people that are out are people who are walking to the synagogue. They're spending part of the day in the synagogue, you know, humbling themselves, afflicting their souls, spending their time praying. But most people are, you know, in their houses. And so most of Israel looks like a ghost town. Most of the Israeli defense force was off on leave. I mean, it was Yom Kippur. And suddenly, 80,000 Egyptian soldiers attacked along the Suez Canal. Now, stationed there, as far as Israeli soldiers go, 500. 80,000 against 500. Syria, who had, again, secretly teamed up with Egypt, sent 1,400 tanks. Remember, Israel's the size of New Jersey. Sending 1,400 tanks into the Golan Heights, attacking Israel's tanks, which there was, Israel only had 180 tanks up there. So we've got 80,000 versus 500 soldiers. We've got 1,400 tanks versus 180 tanks. And then the Iranians got into it with their Hunter jets. And the Iraqis got into it, sending in 18,000 soldiers. So you can guess that this kind of caught Israel by surprise. And it really looked for a couple of days like they were done for. I mean, as I read these things, these statistics to you, you know, how could you believe anything? But they were wiped out and that was the end of that. Totally on the defensive, fighting to stay alive, just to keep from being overrun by an opponent that's ever increasing, because these, you know, over those few days, they kept, you know, more and more troops being supplied and equipment and things. Within just a short time, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Jordan, Kuwait, Syria, Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, Sudan, and Morocco sent thousands of troops in against Israel. Did you get that list? This is worse than the Arab-Israeli war. This is worse than the Six-Day War. This is called the Yom Kippur War. And all of these, they're sending in thousands of troops, multitudes of fighters, bombers, tanks, radar, artillery, armored brigades to aid their Islamic brothers in destroying Israel. And most of these nations, most of them, and this is well documented, were being supplied by the Soviet Union. Russia had a real interest in the Jews. You know, they had recognized them officially, diplomatically. Oh, yes, we recognize you're part of the UN. But, you know, hey, it's not our fault if we're selling and giving all this weaponry to these nations and they're using it to wipe you out. You know, that doesn't have anything to do with us. So it's interesting today that the Soviet Union is not in existence. This promise to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and I will curse those who curse you. Still in existence today. Israel cried out to the world community for help. I mean, hey, they're part of the United Nations, right? They said, help, we're being attacked unprovoked by all of these nations. So what are you going to do? Well, the United States tried to call for a ceasefire. The majority of the world remained silent. They said nothing. The United Nations Security Council did nothing. So here's the United States over here going, hey, stop that. But that was it. And the rest of the world just going, oh, you know, I'm sorry, was there something happening? So Israel's on its own in the world, being attacked, not only from all sides, but all from all these Arab nations. Well, within days, the Israelis mobilized their reserve forces. Remember, by this time, everybody's in the army, right? Or they have been. And so they called up their reserves. They began to fight back offensively, not just on the defense, but offensively. And it wasn't very long before Israel was winning the war. Did you hear what I said? They were winning. They were winning. Outrageous. Again, total miraculous. Like, how does this happen? You're a guy. You're, what was that? Home Alone. What's that little kid? Macaulay Culkin. You're Macaulay Culkin, and you're home alone. And the whole U.S. Army attacks the house. And a few days into it, Macaulay Culkin's winning. Explain this stuff. It doesn't make any earthly sense. None of this makes any earthly sense. God is faithful. Can I remind you that God is faithful to his people? I know this is a history lesson, but you can't really understand and appreciate history without putting God right in the middle of it and saying, you know, if it weren't for God, none of this stuff, Israel wouldn't be around today. All of these nations attacking with tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of troops and equipment and heavy artillery, and they're winning. You know what? They began to push back their opponents. They began to devastate the Egyptians. Devastate, surrounding Egyptian tanks. I mean, with their few tanks and Egypt's huge number of tanks, and just wiping them out. Phenomenal, phenomenal stuff. I highly recommend that you read an article or actually a book about any of these wars, because it's just amazing to see what was done. Well, they're destroying, they're decimating the Egyptians, and guess what? suddenly the world community goes, oh, we need peace here. We need peace. Everybody gets into the thing. Oh, you know, hey, you know, this, no, we need to intervene here. Just when Israel was in a position to completely, and I mean completely destroy Egypt's, was it Egypt's Third Army, suddenly cries for peace come from the Soviet Union. Kurt Waldheim, the UN Secretary General, peace, you know, everybody, come on. October 22nd, 16 days after this attack, the United Nations mandated a halt. So the first few days when Israel's losing, we don't say anything. 16 days later, when they're winning and winning big, suddenly the UN steps in. Oh, this isn't, no, we need peace here. It's amazing, the politics that went on and the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel politics that have continued to this day, but certainly were present then. When all was said and done, 2,700 Israeli soldiers had died. Now, again, as in relation to their population, that's a big number. But if you look at, wait a second, they sent in 1,400 tanks. They sent in 80,000 soldiers, you know, and this was just a couple things and more supply. And they were only able to kill 2,700 Israeli soldiers. Interesting. Very interesting. So either God had his hand in this or the Muslim armies of those days were just incompetent. Or maybe it was a combination of both. I don't know. But I would think that I could take out 1,000 people with just one tank. You know, I mean, I'm not fantasizing about this or anything, but I mean, I would think I played video games. I've taken out hundreds of people with a tank, you know. So now the entire world is concerned about the Arab-Israeli conflict. Everybody's concerned. You know why they're concerned? Well, basically two reasons. For years, it had been rumored, and it seems to be true, although they've never come out and said it. Seems very, very accurate to say that Israel has developed a nuclear weapon and had quite a while ago. Remember, most of the smartest people in the world live there. So you would expect that, as a matter of fact, I don't know if you know this, Albert Einstein was offered the presidency of Israel at one point. Yeah, he politely declined. But anyway, so you got a lot of smart people there. Of course, they've developed a nuclear weapon. It's all but known that they had nuclear capability. And so the U.S., an ally of Israel, and the United States, the USSR, an ally of everyone who hates Israel, are looking at what's happening. Israel is being invaded by all these nations, and they're losing. How could they not use a nuke? If they have the nuke, how could they not use it? Guess what? The USSR goes on nuclear alert because, hey, Israel, if you use a nuke against our allies, we'll use against a nuke against you. The U.S. goes on alert and says, hey, Russia, if you use a nuke against Israel because they use the nuke against your allies, then we'll use the nukes against you. So we're almost looking at World War III because of this little country the size of New Jersey. And so the world was kind of concerned about this. You know, you would think it was the height of the Cold War, certainly. The second reason, the Arab members of OPEC, you know, the whole petroleum conglomerate out there, the Arab members of OPEC at the end of this announced that they would no longer ship petroleum to any of the nations who'd supported Israel. So there were some Western European nations that had spoken in defense. There was the United States that had airlifted some equipment and certainly was an ally. And OPEC said, you don't get any more of our oil. And they said to the rest of the world, did we mention that we're increasing prices by 400%? Do you remember this? Were you around back then, 1973, 1974? We had a little bit of an oil crisis. Gas stations out of gas. Wait, cars run out of gas. Gas stations never run out of gas. Oh, yes, they do. Lines for miles, rationing. You remember even day, odd day, based on your license plate, all that stuff. Guess what? It was Israel's fault for existing. For existing. Because the OPEC nations hated them, the Arab nations of OPEC. So suddenly what happens in the Middle East, affects everybody. It had devastated our economy. You know, nowadays, if we get a home loan at 6%, 7%, you know, it's like, wow, you know, man, that's a lot. You know, a year ago, they were getting 4% and 5% on the home loans and stuff. And it's the lousy credit cards. It's like the Sears credit card that charges 21%, 22%. People were getting home loans at 22%. The economy was a mess. Japan's economy was totally devastated by this. So the whole world is concerned with what happens in the Middle East all of a sudden. And you know what? Not a lot of people really care about Israel. You know, if the Muslim nations came in and wiped them out, it's just, it's too bad Israel had those nukes as a deterrent. Because at any point, you know, let's just have them wiped out and then everybody plays nice again. So between the nuclear threat from the U.S. and the Soviet Union and the oil threat from OPEC, everybody's real concerned. And from that point in history, as much as I can pinpoint it, I would say from that point in history, it seems like nothing Israel has done, not a thing that Israel has done, has been without international criticism. From the politicians, from the UN, from the media, Israel's the bad guy now. You know why Israel's the bad guy? Because they exist. Because if they weren't there, the Middle East would just produce oil and everybody would be fine. So the world really isn't a big fan of Israel. 1978, Jimmy Carter. You remember Jimmy Carter? He brought the Israeli prime minister, at the time Menachem Begin, and Anwar Sadat, Egypt's president, brought them together at Camp David, 1978. I remember our teacher, I hate to admit how young I am at times, I remember watching this historic event. I was in fifth grade or sixth grade, and the teacher wheeled in the television set and said, "This is huge." And we watched Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat and Jimmy Carter sign some papers, and everybody shook hands and clapped, and we went, well, at least we didn't have to do math, you know. You know what? He had kept at, when we saw that signing, what we didn't know, number one, I was a kid and I didn't understand any of this, but what I didn't know was Jimmy Carter had told Begin and Sadat, taken them to Camp David and said, "We're going to work this out. And I'm hesitant to even let you guys leave until it's worked out." They were there for 13 days. And there was times when they weren't speaking and everything was a mess. And it was a big deal. It was a very big deal. But they came out with what's called the Camp David Accords, if you're familiar with that. And Israel would return the Sinai Peninsula, you know, for the second time. Okay, you can have it back. You know, we got it from you twice. You can have it back. We'll dismantle some of the Jewish settlements, you know, and Egypt would try to play nice. So what's interesting, though, this attempt at peace, this shows you where the Muslim mindset of the Arab nations is. Egypt really didn't make any concessions. You know, they got it back and they said, you know, okay, we'll try and play nice sort of thing. But it wasn't like they said, okay, we're allies now. It was just a mutual, like, okay, we promise not to try and totally annihilate you, you know. This made Egypt so unpopular with the Muslim nations. They had totally betrayed, in the Muslim mindset, and we talked about this early in our history and future study about the Muslim mindset, about the Quran teaches the destruction of the Jews. And here, Egypt is not doing a very Muslim thing. They're talking with Jews. You know, they're saying they're going to try and play nice with them. Well, that's unacceptable. So Egypt was kicked out of the Arab League for this. And 3 years later, Anwar Sadat was assassinated. You might remember that as well. So clearly the Muslim nations have no agenda beyond the total destruction of Israel. There's just no two ways about it. And nobody can produce any proof otherwise. Okay, so we haven't been looking at Iraq. Iraq had been trying to get nuclear weaponry for quite a while. They'd been trying to buy a nuclear reactor. I'm forgetting now the testing reactors. I forget what they're called, but basically to make stuff to make nuclear bombs with, you know, and nuclear power, but they hadn't been looking to buy that. Finally, the French said, hey, we'll sell you a reactor or a nuclear materials testing reactor. So here this thing is being built. Now, common sense tells you that Iraq isn't looking for a cheap source of power. Iraq is looking for power. Power to you know, manipulate the politics and overcome certainly the Jews and as we saw later, even against the other Muslims, it didn't matter. But before it went online, it became evident that from what they were buying and what they were building and what they were putting together was this was going to produce nuclear weapons. There was no two ways about it. And what's interesting is Iran was so nervous about this that in 1980, they tried to attack this thing. Iran, another Muslim nation, tried to blow up this nuclear reactor as it's being built because they realized, you guys aren't building this for nuclear power. You're gonna dominate us. You're going to have nuclear weapons and you live right next door kind of thing. So they tried and they failed miserably. Iraq was able to defend the place, shot down the planes and things. And so, well, the Israelis knew that to allow the construction of this would mean their destruction. And time was of the essence because it's almost finished. And when it goes hot, when it goes online, when it starts up, if they try and blow it up then, guess what the world sees? You blew up a nuclear reactor and all those Iraqi citizens all around, in the neighborhoods all around, were irradiated. You know, they're all going to, they die of radiation sickness or poisoning or ultimately of cancer. This is your fault. So they said, time is of the essence. They planned this. They practiced for it. It was precision. They flew almost 700 miles outside of Israeli territory on June 7th, 1981 and leveled the place. Again, Israel's in a political hurricane because they're trying to defend themselves from psychos that want to blow them up. And they had done it. They needed to do it. And yet, you know, they did it with as much care and concern for civilians as they could. And didn't matter. They're in a political hurricane again. The nations all over the place condemning the attack, including the United States condemning the attack. The next year, the PLO, which is now based in Lebanon, Yasser Arafat had actually been kicked out of Jordan. Because he was such a bad guy, even Muslims didn't like him, you know. So he's kicked out of Jordan. He sets up shop in Lebanon, in Beirut. And the acts of terrorism that had gone on from the PLO had gone on at this point for 15 years. And they were a regular part of life. So they, and now that they're based in Lebanon, they're basically just across the border here and they're launching attacks again, these strategic locations and, missile launches and mortars and incursions and all kinds of things. Most of them at this point, because the PLO is based in Lebanon, are coming from Lebanon. And Israel says, okay, we need to make an incursion into Lebanon to drive the PLO back, essentially drive them 40 kilometers or 25 miles, give or take. 25 miles north, because that will put them out of, that will put us out of their missile range, or it will put them out of range of us, essentially. So, June 6th, 1982, the Israeli Defense Forces invaded southern Lebanon, not for the purpose of destroying Lebanon, just for driving the PLO out. Well, Syria got involved, the Air Force comes in, joins the fight, and Israel says, well, you know, we're not going to get bombed here. So they had to take on Syria's air force. Interesting, Israel shot down 80 Syrian planes. Syria shot down no Israeli planes at all. Zero. 80 to nothing. Now there's a high school football game for you, you know. 80 to nothing. Israel ended up continuing north all the way to Beirut, where the PLO's headquarters was, where Yasser Arafat was, to drive them out. Military success, but again, Israel defending itself, political disaster. The world is fine with the PLO blowing up buses full of school children, but as soon as Israel says, hey, we're going in there and we're going to put a stop to this, oh no, that's wrong, the world comes out and says, again, log in your own eye, world. There's a supernatural hatred and anti-Semitism against Israel, against the Jews, inexplicable other than the devil. So political disaster. To make matters worse, Israel had allied itself with the counter group in Lebanon, the Christian militias in Lebanon that were fighting against the Muslim Lebanese government. So, and put them in charge of some of the refugee camps of Palestinians and Arabs that were either captured or driven out into these areas. Well, the Christian Lebanese militias took this opportunity to get their pound of flesh and massacred Arab Palestinians in two different camps. Israel hadn't been a part of it, but because they were allied with these Christian Lebanese militias, it was of course the world said it was their fault. Ariel Sharon, you might know who Ariel Sharon is. He's been the prime minister of Israel since 2001. He was the Israeli defense minister at the time. He was found personally indirectly responsible and fired, essentially. He was demoted. So then after the invasion of Lebanon, Iran sends in 1,500 revolutionary guards to organize Shiite Muslim Lebanese groups. This is the kind of the, we've talked about Shiites before, sort of the even more psycho Muslim, you know, anti-Jew sort of denomination of Islam, to organize them into a political party. And obviously this political party has the agenda of destroy Israel, launch terrorist attacks, those kind of things. They called it the Party of Allah, Hezbollah. And you should be familiar with that term, Hezbollah. This is the group who claimed responsibility for the suicide bombing of the U.S. Embassy and the Marine barracks in Beirut. That should all be pretty fresh in our memory. They regularly kidnap, torture, and murder Israelis and citizens of country, of nations that are allied. Yeah, you might recall an army. It's a U.S. colonel that was kidnapped and tortured mercilessly before he was finally murdered by Hezbollah. The British have suffered losses because of them as well. Attacks from Muslim nations surrounding them, as if this isn't enough. Well, the Palestinian Arab population, that is the Arabs in the nation of Israel now, in 1987 began a massive uprising. And if you want to know how this took place, just watch the news from France this last week. And, you know, in France this last week, a couple of teenagers, Muslim teenagers, were running from the cops and or thought they were running from the cops and hid in some electrical substation, got electrocuted. And what have we seen now? What has taken place in Paris and all over France for the last week or so? A couple weeks now, I guess. Riots. Cars being burned up, people, babies being injured, old women set on fire, buses blown up, all kinds of stuff. It's the Muslims who say, we're getting a bad deal here, and trash the place. Well, this is exactly what happened after a car accident. Four Palestinians were killed in a car accident, in a traffic incident. And the Palestinians, that was the spark. One of the four that died was a youngster, was a little kid. And this set the spark to start a series of riots. Well, the PLO sees these riots start, and you know what they do? Because of Yasser Arafat's direction, what the PLO does is they tell Muslims all over Israel, we will pay you for continuing this. Like if you initiate another riot, then, I mean, we'll put you on the payroll. And so, you know, hey, this is money. This is easy money. The PLO is paying us to, you know, so they offered money to provoke more riots. And this was, you know, a lot of it consisted of rock throwing and tire burning and some attacks against Israeli soldiers and things. This is called the First Intifada. And the Intifada is a name that you'll hear quite a bit. Or the Intifada is Arabic for casting off or shaking off. So they're like, we're going to throw off the Israeli oppressors. 7 years, lasted about 7 years. And then You got to talk about the Gulf War for a minute, and I know I'm rapidly running out of time. During the First Intifada, so Israel is looking at this daily riots on the Palestinians' part, being promoted by the PLO and financed. Israel's looking at a really difficult situation defensively because Iraq invaded Kuwait, and this is when Saddam Hussein is now in charge. He invades Kuwait and uses the opportunity to start launching Scud missiles into Israel. It has no, Israel has nothing to do with your invasion of Kuwait, but, you know, hey, I've got missiles and you're Jews, so let's blow you up, Saddam was thinking. Well, guess what? Israel, this is 1991, Israel is no dummy, and they know that whatever they do, if they defend themselves against Iraq, guess what? All the Muslim nations of the world, they're not going to help the United States and this UN coalition destroy Iraq. They're going to go to war with Israel, and we've got World War III on our hands just because Israel would defend itself. You see how Islam and international politics have put Israel in a place where they have no hope. I mean, they have no ability to do anything. So Scud missiles are being launched at Israel, and we like to think, hey, you know, remember the Patriot missiles? We saw this on television. We were watching this live every night, you know, watching the Scud missiles being launched and the Patriot missiles. The U.S. came into Israel and, you know, tried to shoot down the Scud missiles. Well, 39 Scuds we didn't get. They landed in places like Israeli shopping malls and things. So, you know, but again, they can't defend themselves. Even though it's a legitimate act of war, the Arab nations have never stopped being in a state of war with Israel. The majority of them today are in a state of war with Israel, in case you didn't know. But they're not allowed to defend themselves. 93, Bill Clinton tries to initiate the Oslo Accords, if you're familiar with that. It's when the prime minister, again, and Yasser Arafat this time, not Egypt, but Yasser Arafat, terrorist, being recognized by the United States government as a legitimate party leader, as, hey, you know, for you know, you're the head guy of all these Palestinians, and meeting with Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister of Israel, the United States welcoming him, Yasser Arafat, terrorist, butcher of countless people, author and financer of countless acts of terrorism, bringing him in as a diplomat. I was sick when I saw this, and I preached against it numerous times. Did no good. Bill Clinton wasn't tuning into my messages. Big deal was made about the Oslo Accords, you know, which you know, would basically do nothing. In the year 2000, Clinton tried to bring Yasser Arafat and this time Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister at that point, together to continue this peace process. Negotiations collapse. Well, that's in 2000. And then in 2000, Ariel Sharon, who is now the head of basically the opposition party against Ehud Barak, you know, he's continued in politics. And Ariel Sharon gets reports from Israeli archaeologists that up on Temple Mount, Muslims are building another mosque, and at the site of where Solomon's temple was, or not Solomon's temple, Solomon's stables, where all those horses he collected were, and they're destroying the antiquity. They're ruining Jewish relics, essentially. So he goes up to investigate. Ariel Sharon, war criminal, as far as the Muslims are concerned, going to the Palestinians' capital city, because they look at Jerusalem as their capital. This visit to Temple Mount initiated, guess what? Muslim riots. And this is called the Second Intifada. Started in 2000, continued on until this year. And again, it's not like it's really stopped, but around the beginning of 2005, there were some things that were done that part of the peace process to try and get them to stop this. Acts of terrorism during that time abounded, daily attacks, suicide bombings. That's why for the last 5 years we've watched Israel on TV every night with the suicide bombers, which, by the way, The Al Jazeera news service, this is the Muslim news service. It's like Reuters for us or the Associated Press. For them, it's Al Jazeera. They don't use the term suicide bombers anymore. They call them paradise operations. So when you read a Muslim newspaper and it talks about somebody blowing up a bus, it was a paradise operation because their belief is they die killing infidels. They immediately get whisked away to paradise with 70 virgins in their harem and all the rest of the nonsense that they preach. So daily attacks, suicide bombings, Israel's response is the West Bank barrier. Now, understand that you probably have a fence around your house, right? I mean, you've got a fence separating the neighbor's house from your house. Seems only right, right? What is it? Keeps the neighbor's dog from coming into your house, keeps the neighbors from coming into your, you know, into your yard kind of thing. So just about everybody in the world is allowed to put a fence around their house. And just about every nation of the world is allowed to put a fence at the borders to keep illegal immigrants. So you're allowed to keep out the neighbor's dog. We, you know, down at the Mexican border, ideally, we're allowed to keep out illegal immigrants. But Israel built the West Bank barrier, which is a series of fences and walls and trenches outlining Israeli territory and West Bank Palestinian territory. What's the matter with that? It's a humanitarian disaster, the world says. It's not, you're taking away their human rights, and the Palestinians' are human rights. And again, they're not even allowed to put up a fence to keep not dogs out, not illegal immigrants out, to keep terrorists out, suicide bombers, people that are killing their citizens on a daily basis. But they're not allowed to build a fence. Do you see what's happened in the last 50 years to Israel? They're not allowed to do anything without international criticism, without anything. This has brought outrage. Israel's attempt to protect its citizens has brought international outrage for building a fence. So most recently we saw in September, just a couple months ago, Ariel Sharon ordered Israel's pullout from the Gaza Strip in an attempt to trade land for peace. I've preached against the whole land for peace thing numerous times. I'll say it again. I expect we'll see a lot more international pressure to pull out not only of the Gaza Strip, but of all the disputed territories, the occupied territories that they legitimately won in war. But so there will be that push. And, you know, certainly we saw that in Gaza. There's already demands to give back parts of Judea and Samaria in exchange, you know, in expectation that it will bring peace. Give the Palestinians land and there will be peace. Does anybody here believe that? I don't believe it. It goes against everything that we've seen in history. It goes against what the Bible has shown to us. It goes against what every Islamic nation has said. And in case you think this is ancient history, I don't know if you caught the news on October 26th when Iran's president made a somewhat controversial statement. Interestingly, nobody, not any news service that I could find, United States news service that I could find, reported where he was when he made this statement. He was in Tehran, in Iran, the city in Iran, at a conference. You know what the name of the conference was? The World Without Zionism. So the president, can you imagine if George Bush went to a seminar, to a conference in Washington, D.C. called Imagine a World Without Jews? And yet it's perfectly acceptable for the Iranian president to do this. Well, the statement that he made was pretty clear. October 26th, he said Israel should be, quote, wiped off the map. This is still the position of the Arab nations today. And there's no two ways about it. He made the mistake of actually saying it out loud in today's politically correct, you know, era. But we won't do anything about it. The United Nations won't do anything about it. They'll say, bad president, no biscuit. But there's no effect. So this is what we can expect to see. And as we move into, next time we'll talk about the state of the church today, but as we move into prophecy, what we're going to see is this is going to continue. And ultimately, we're going to see every nation, including if the United States is still around, which I don't know. Every nation, the Bible says, all the nations of the world will be gathered against Jerusalem. So Israel's situation is really bad right now. The future promises that it's going to get worse before it gets better. But it is going to get better. And that's the good news that we should end with tonight. Father, we're thankful that you've been faithful to your people, that that whole David and Goliath thing that we've seen even in our own lifetimes, your miraculous intervention, and we know that your heart is towards your people, that your eyes are upon the land of Israel. We know that the future is not pretty. You certainly desire the Jews of the world to come to repentance, but you've given them such amazing promises that you will carry them through to the other side of what's going to be a really, really big and disturbing and deadly mess. But we look forward to the day, Jesus, when you return as king to rule not only Israel, but over all the nations of the earth. We're looking forward to that day, Lord. We're practically holding our breath, waiting for these things to happen. So we pray, come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. We know that you're coming soon, and we pray that we would be found ready and that we would continue to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. Jesus, we pray these things in your name. Amen.